Hello, family from Redeemer Presbyterian Church, or church family, I should say. This is the third week of our series on American Presbyterianism. This week we'll be going over the modernism and fundamentalism debate. And as you can see on slide 20, if you have the ability to pull that up, I have a picture of what looks like a stern grandmother. I guess I'd imagine she's a stern grandmother from Western Pennsylvania, and in her left hand she has the Bible, and in her right hand she has the hatchet. And the question begs, what on earth is this lady doing in this picture? And I want to keep pointing back to social factors really influence the church more than we sometimes realize. Again, it's easier to know that when you study history than when history's unfolding in the present. But in this particular slide, this was a lady that was against alcohol and would have, I forget what amendment prohibition is off the top of my head. I don't have Bob Lasore to correct me at this moment, but wanted to prohibit alcohol. And so last week I had said we need to be careful against moralism. There's been a tendency to be moralistic in the Christian American Presbyterianism and American evangelicalism at large. And I think during Prohibition, that's one of the things that happened. Forming a, quote, Christian nation takes precedence over the transformation of the gospel. And I think that's always important for us to realize, especially transformation type of ministry, which I don't necessarily have a problem with, but it can kind of go wayward and basically turn into make Christianity great again or try to basically turn Christianity or the clock back on where we've came from to a type of Christendom, so to speak, in America. And I think we need to guard against that. And next year, when we get to Galatians in the spring, we'll do, after we finish our series in Acts, we will do Ruth, and then after we do Ruth, we'll go into Galatians. We'll really see that Paul, in particular, really goes after the so-called moralists, or in that text, they would be called Judaizers. And I think there's always been there's one pendulum that goes way far in the other direction, where it's way too libertine, I guess you would say. And the other end of the spectrum is a more type of moralism. And it's been interesting in the American tradition, we kind of have the pendulum swing between that it goes back and forth, and I think we need to be aware of that. So the picture is kind of funny in a way, and to me kind of a little bit scary. But at the same time, I firmly believe perhaps this lady was a lady that really loved the Lord, but you can kind of see how she wrapped up moralism and scripture together, where it maybe wasn't there, maybe she needed to. One of the cases that I'd like to make is maybe instead of making that in the Bible per se, just talk about public policy, so to speak, and how we can adjust that. Just like smoking, for example, I don't need to bring in the public sphere. I just need to talk about the science behind smoking and how it's bad for you, not to prohibit it from the Bible and have a hatchet in my hand. So, but perhaps if I had lived during the time period, I would have been more sympathetic. I just don't know because I never lived through that time period. So now we are on slide 21, if I could get my computer to work properly. So during the fundamentalist and modernist debate, you can see the picture of the old Scofield Bible. If I remember correctly, Scofield was a lawyer and went around preaching. But there's some really important social factors that influence the modernist fundamentalist debate. So number one is immigration. So temperance, and when it happened, a lot of people might not realize this, but one of the kind of important social factors that's going on during that time period is you got a lot of immigrants coming from Catholic nations. So in fact, during this time period, my great grandparents would have came from Poland. And one thing that is happening, and there is battles between ideas. People really did believe drinking was bad. But in terms of the sphere of immigration, for example, one of the things that perhaps was fueling the fire, so to speak, on this immigration topic was the fact that America up until that point in the 1920s is dominated by the Anglo-American tradition, where you have Protestants And that's really kind of the only option. Well, sociologists kind of state that perhaps what's going on during this time period with the temperance movement is the fact that people that are from Anglo-Protestant stock, who were really not religious in the first place, see these immigrants coming from predominantly Catholic countries and kind of look inward and say, hey, I really need to start learning how to be a good Protestant, and I need to stop drinking. And that's kind of what Catholics are the ones that get carried away with drinking. So that's kind of a sociological thing that's going on. Now, again, I want to be fair because I do think a lot of what goes on is the battle of ideas, not so much just cultural things. I think we can get caught up in always explaining things away in sociological terms. But I do think that is there. So temperance is tied to immigration, I think. Science is another big topic going on during this time period. We will see this with the so-called Scopes trial. Evolution kind of kicks into gear. I think the dust has kind of settled on that one, and it's kind of going away. But I even think back to my time at Liberty University. We had creation science. And now that I think about it, and I had studied Hebrew Bible and understand it, I didn't really like the fact that we had a bunch of scientists who really are not skilled at interpreting the Bible well in terms of the original languages, trying to explain to me what was going on with the science in the Bible. I actually think they didn't care as much about what the Bible said. It was more of a political type of class, in all honesty. So even though there were some things that I learned in the class that were quite interesting and that I would agree with, I do hesitate to think that it was maybe tied to a more politicalization of science. And there's many other topics. Those are just kind of the interesting ones. So we can actually still feel the tension from this movement. So, for example, if I were to theoretically bring up introducing wine into our communion, I actually think for most of us, we'd probably have opinions that we could probably, if we had like a tree, a family tree of ideas, they would probably stem all the way back to the temperance movement. So it really does shape us, and I still think it kind of shapes American evangelical institutions at large. So I have Schofield on the slide, and one of the interesting things is the big evangelical institutions, which do train EPC ministers, still have this kind of dispensationalist streak that goes all the way back to the 1920s. And in their confessional documents, typically you have to sign off on the rapture or many other things, which I would disagree with as a Reformed Presbyterian now. But what's so interesting is this moralist, modernist, fundamentalist debate is kind of waning in my generation and under. And what's ended up happening is a lot of Dallas Theological Seminary is kind of like the poster child for this. A lot of talented students that went on to do PhDs at really great institutions cannot come back and teach at Dallas Theological Seminary because they don't want to sign off on dispensationalism. They've gone off to do their PhD work and become either Presbyterian or Anglican. That seems to be kind of the two biggest trends that for students that I know. So I find this quite interesting. And in other institutions that we might be familiar with, Fuller, I think, had this tied into their confessional statement at one time. I don't know if Gordon Conwell did. We have a lot of pastors that went there. I know Chris Matheson, who served us for a while, went to school there. And Jim Mulk did as well. Trinity Evangelical Divinity School. My last pastor did his PhD there, and he was asked to come on staff to teach in the pastoral theology department, but actually could not sign off on the confessional statement because he was a Presbyterian and was what's called an amillennialist. And we went over this, I think, maybe about 2 years ago when I first started eschatology. But what was interesting is he couldn't sign off on it, and he would always point me and the other pastor on staff when we would do my kind of my luncheons that I had to do during my internship. He would point us back and say, well, it's all kind of tied back to that modernist fundamentalist debate. And even the term evangelical itself and the sense that we use it today really comes out of this debate. So that's what I find really, really interesting. So I'm on slide number 22 now. That is a picture of B.B. Warfield, who was a theology professor at Princeton Theological Seminary. He's often called the last great Orthodox thinker that came out of Princeton Theological Seminary. Wrote a really important book on the topic of inerrancy, kind of hammered that out. It's so good, or at least the way he defends it, that it's kind of the book to go to when you study that topic. And nobody's really ever defeated B.B. Warfield. Pretty interesting guy and individual. His wife was paralyzed or got really sick when they were young and they were married. They weren't able to have children. He stayed married to her for many years and was her caregiver. And basically what he did his whole entire career was take care of his wife and teach theology. He was prodigious, able to write a bunch, but he's just an interesting guy. They were unable to have children because of her sickness, and he was a faithful husband until her death. So not only a man of great scholarly acumen, but a wonderful guy who served his wife dearly. So the modernist fundamentalist controversy, again, has dominated Presbyterianism in particular. Even the breakaway denominations, the EPC, the PCA, the OPC, as we'll see this morning, really, you could tie all these debates back to to what is going on socially in the 1920s. But I always like to say during these debates, there's actually what I would call a third option, and I would call that the confessionalist option. People that could retain the term Presbyterian. See, I can't talk this morning. But could also be an evangelical as well. And I want to kind of give us a person that I think kind of embodies this tradition quite well. And to be quite honest, when I read his book the first time, I totally read him wrong. So that person, as we see on slide 23, is J. Gresham Machen. Now, Machen's a really interesting fellow. He's somebody that kind of fits into the confessionalist option. And when I read his book, I think it's called The Fundamentals of Christianity, I thought he was a fundamentalist and totally did not read the book correctly. And it only took me until a second time that I totally understood what he was talking about in the book. During his time, there's a lot of ministers that are being ordained that are basically denying the essential tenets of the Christian faith, such as the bodily resurrection. Or I'm sorry, it's called Christianity and Liberalism. So he goes through this book and investigates the topic and eventually says, liberal Christianity is not Christianity at all. And he publishes this even in I think somewhere in the 1920s or shortly after. He's actually a guest lecturer, I think, at Grove City College. So perhaps Bob and Lisa can attest to this. I don't know. You might even be able to get your hands on the lectures and be able to read them. But he's a really interesting fellow because he's somebody that fits the more confessionalist type of mode. So he kind of escapes this divide of modernist and fundamentalism, and I would say he actually embodies as a third option, which is really the minority opinion, which is the confessionalist opinion, where people are not ashamed to call themselves Presbyterians and hold fast to their confession. I think confessions are a good thing. They keep us and guard us from getting into trouble. So what's so interesting about Machen is he's somebody who would have known famous people such as Woodrow Wilson. President Woodrow Wilson's uncle, for example, was a preaching professor at Princeton Theological Seminary, and I believe he taught at a seminary out in Ohio, Steubenville, I believe, somewhere around that area. But he's famous, Machen is, for hobnobbing for people that really mattered. And we have to remember at this particular time, if you're a Presbyterian, Presbyterians even to this day are kind of upper middle class still, but they're kind of with the Episcopalians, kind of the people that run the country. So this is the type of crowd that Machen runs around. He knows Woodrow Wilson, he knows William James Bryan, if I'm remembering his name correctly, and all the kind of other famous Presbyterians that matter. I know Calvin Coolidge, I think, was a Congregationalist but a Calvinistic one, albeit. So I wouldn't be surprised if Machen knew him personally. So Machen's born into a rather rich family. He's somebody who never actually was married, and he's somebody that kind of embodies this rich boy mentality. So in his journals, he talks about going to baseball games a lot. He really liked to go to theater. He loved music. He went on like retreats basically to Europe, and he could bankroll this because he came from a really wealthy family. He came from the South originally, or his family, so to escape, this is before air conditioning, to escape the warm weather in the summers from Georgia or where he was living at the time, what he would end up doing is him and his mom, because he never got married, he was kind of a mama's boy, they would go to vacation up in Maine, where it's a lot cooler, which I can attest to because I was there last year in the summer, and it was quite cool still. So he's a rich boy. And one of the characters that he kind of battles against in this time period, we see on slide 24. This is Henry Fosdick. Now Henry Fosdick was originally ordained a Baptist, but he was eventually called to serve at First Presbyterian Church in New York City. So he's somebody that transferred into the Presbyterian tradition and nonetheless continued to minister out of bounds, so to speak. So what's interesting is a Baptist is the one who's famous. We tend to think Baptist now. We think somebody who's rather conservative in their theology. But that's not true with Henry Fosdick. So Henry Fosdick in New York City at First Presbyterian Church preaches a really famous sermon entitled, "Shall the Fundamentalists Win?" And in this sermon, if you go back and you read it, there's basically two themes that stand out. He looks pretty austere in the picture in slide 24, and like a well-respected guy. But anyways, back to the presentation. He critiques the Bible not being the literal word of God. And number two, he emphasizes the belief in human progress. So he essentially believes the Bible is foolish for believing that men are sinful and fallen. So he preaches this famous sermon and gets rung up on charges. Orthodox Presbyterians get really frustrated and mad at him. And I think at this time that this is most of the teachers at Princeton Theological Seminary. Princeton Theological Seminary at one time before Machen and his crew kind of split from them was kind of the bastion for Orthodox Presbyterianism. Even going back to the first week of our presentation, remember Princeton battled against Yale, essentially, against New Haven theology. Well, Princetonians battled against them because they were more of a traditionalist. And they're also the type who loved polemics. I think polemical arguments were quite famous at Princeton Theological Seminary. So in his defense for this famous sermon, "Shall the Fundamentalists Win?" Just again to highlight the high life of the Presbyterians at this time. They're kind of the 1%, so to speak, that we hear about all the time in the news anymore. Just to show you this, his defense lawyer was a ruling elder whose name is John Foster Dulles. So if you've ever flown through Washington, D.C., I'm almost positive that airport is named after him. So this is a gentleman who's a lawyer and who defends Henry Fosdick, which kind of shows you who he is on the theological spectrum. And again, goes back to this moralism. It's not just the fundamentalists who are the prohibition people who want to moralize America. It's also kind of the religious elite establishment. They don't really care about Christian orthodoxy. They want to kind of teach people through the church to be good citizens and believe in human progress. Well, that's what Fosdick and Dulles are doing. Now, the real irony of John Foster Dulles is his son actually was a Catholic priest and left the Presbyterian tradition and became a Catholic priest. He had a conversion experience in college and often thought, well, why? It's kind of a shame Avery Dulles, is his name, did not stay in the Presbyterian tradition. But then again, I thought to myself, well, this story kind of helped me see that his dad was not really an Orthodox Christian. He's somebody that essentially just used his religious tradition and kind of merged it with his politics. So religion, merging religion and politics goes together as much on the right as it does the left. And one thing I'm trying to get us to realize through this whole series is the fact that if we are confessionalists, if we have a more two kingdoms perspective, so to speak, and maybe I'll do a Sunday school lesson on that one time, I think we can kind of escape that trap. So Avery Dulles is John Foster Wallace's son. So slide 25, we have a picture from the newspaper about the trial of Machen. He eventually gets in trouble too because he kind of battles with the PC, what would eventually become the PCUSA. So it just kind of shows how different the times are now when a pastor is rung up on theological disputes, that this would actually make the newspaper. I don't think if anybody in the EPC got in trouble for what was going on, that they would have continued to publish this in the newspaper. That's just unthinkable to me. I know in the EPC we had a famous case in the EPC history book that I've read where somebody was disciplined for preaching universalism. And I really highly doubt that that was brought up in the newspapers in Colorado. I believe that's where it happened. So that just kind of shows you the time period where being Presbyterian really mattered. Being religious really mattered. It's just a whole different world than the one that I grew up in. So the Presbyterians split thanks to Machen, and he kind of got a reputation for being somebody who was kind of a rebel rouser, and they split. I have a slide on slide 26 kind of show Presbyterians' missions in Korea, which is really interesting. But Machen's original beef with the PCUSA and what got him in trouble was over his stance on missions. He believed that they were moving away from the proclamation of the gospel to a more humanitarian work, and that was what frustrated him and why he wanted to change some things and push for change. So he's rung up on charges on being a rebel rouser, and he's kicked out of the mainline church. So again, back to him being a rich boy on slide 26, what's so interesting about him is he was a single man. He never married. He was tremendously wealthy, and he used up a lot of his money to start Westminster Theological Seminary, which originally was kind of a rival and kind of still is to Princeton Theological Seminary. And he eventually starts the Orthodox Presbyterian Church as well. But what's interesting is he uses most of his estate to start both of these institutions. And remember back again to the opening, or one of the opening slides when we worked through him, he was somebody who came from a family that really mattered. He came from kind of the 1%, and for him to actually break off and start Westminster Theological Seminary, that comes with a lot of social cost. I don't think sometimes we realize that. He should be commended for that. That's quite amazing that he actually did that. And I've actually heard that when you walk through the halls of Princeton Theological Seminary, that Machen is nowhere to be found. He was kind of the bad boy, so to speak, that fought against them and broke the church apart. Wherein, if you're of a more orthodox perspective, you see Machen as kind of a hero in Presbyterian history. So now I'm on slide 27. So after the Presbyterian split, it really foreshadows to the split between the PCUSA and the PCA and the EPC as well. The essentials of the faith in the Evangelical Presbyterian Church really come out of traditionally what are the fundamentals of the faith. I always want to remind us when we say the word fundamentalist, now it's such a pejorative and negative term, but if you go back and you read it in its context, it's essentially what we confess as the essentials of the EPC. So our essential tenets in the EPC are essentially the same tenets that the fundamentalists were pushing for people to believe and were pushing for their ministers to believe. it's just preposterous to me personally that you would ever ordain somebody that didn't believe in the physical body, bodily resurrection of Jesus Christ. If they want to use that for political purposes, just go join, in an American context, just go join the Democratic Progressive Party and push for that. I don't understand why they need to push that in the local church. But again, kind of back to that moralistic framework, if that's kind of the way you see the world, I think it makes more sense, or it helps you understand people in their social context. So slide 28 now. Machen should be admired because he had a lot to lose socially. So I want to remind us of that. Again, I've read and have friends that went to Princeton Theological Seminary, and he's eventually scrubbed from their halls. So I have a picture of Karl Barth on slide 28. And what's interesting is they're kind of contemporaries. But Machen ends up starting Westminster and kind of that trajectory. And then Barth ends up becoming such a huge influence at Princeton Theological Seminary. Much that sometimes Princeton Theological Seminary comes across as they care more about Karl Barth than the Bible, but that's a whole different story. It's interesting when I have friends that have been trained at Princeton, Barth is a really big deal. The German tradition is a really big deal. And if you go to an evangelical institution such as myself, American evangelicalism has really been influenced by England. So I'm more familiar with the great thinkers that have come out of the English tradition. That's another interesting family tree where the main line is really influenced by the German thinkers, whereas evangelicalism is more focused on England. And you can see this in PhDs. Evangelicals or conservative Presbyterians that do their PhDs typically go to the UK or do them here in the United States, whereas maybe some of the more mainliners, they would have went over to Germany. And I believe Machen did his PhD in Germany as well. Another interesting thing about Machen is apparently if you're a bad preacher and weren't preaching well, he would take his English Bible out of the pew and sit there bored and translate it back into Greek. And I can attest that would be an extremely hard thing to do, but that just kind of shows how smart he was. So Machen's courage. And finally, in our slide this week, slide 29, we have the Scopes trial, which is another really interesting event in Presbyterian history. So again, Machen is more of a confessionalist. He's not a fundamentalist and he's not a liberal. So he doesn't really fit neatly into that debate. But he was called, as you can see in the picture, by William James Bryan as a special witness for the Scopes trial. And he ended up declining. And the reason why he declined is he said, I'm a New Testament scholar. I am not an authority on science. And he wanted to defend the New Testament. He didn't even really want to teach on the Old Testament as well. But he kind of snubbed Bryan, so to speak, who again is kind of a big deal in that time period. And Bryan, who I believe went all the way up to Secretary of State during the Woodrow Wilson administration, was somebody who was more of a moralist, so to speak. So Machen was not a moralist. He was more interested in the gospel. He also saw through perhaps the American tradition, both on the left and the right, to moralize the country. So the fundamentalists want to reform through their moralistic lens, through prohibition during this time period, and many other kind of endeavors. And the religious left really want to moralize the nation and turn the church into a champion of human progress. And if you go back and you read the sermons from these specific time periods, you can kind of see that. And I think it's kind of the biggest takeaway as we close from this is the lesson learned can be and should be, we need to stay clear of that. And again, as we work through Galatians next spring, we'll kind of see we need to hold fast and strong to the gospel. And I think Machen did a really good job at that. He did a really good job understanding Paul and the great social cost that comes with following the Lord Jesus Christ. The idea of worth is reconfigured and changed around Jesus Christ. And I think Machen really understood that well and essentially kind of threw away the high life that he was involved in. And for that, and the biggest takeaway from him, I think he's somebody that really needs to be looked up for and somebody. So thank you for week number 3.